Here's Elizabeth Jackson with Correspondence Report.
Thanks, Tom. Welcome. Our Indonesia correspondent Samantha Hawley recently spent some time in the infamous Kerabakan prison in Bali for an episode of Foreign Correspondent. She met with two of the Bali Nine members, Matthew Norman and Siyi Chen, who are both serving life sentences. Here's some of Sam's interview with Matthew Norman, who was jailed when he was just 18 years old.
My name's Matthew Norman, and I'm a prisoner here in Kerabakan prison in Bali. I've been here since 2005. And I have a life sentence.
And how old are you now?
I'm now 30 years old.
Describe to me then what you were like when you were 18.
Reckless, careless, wanting to cut corners in life, which is hence why I'm in my position now. So, yeah.
What sort of upbringing did you have?
I had a good upbringing. I had a good family. My dad was always good to us. And yeah, really good relatives and all that. It's just, I had a good upbringing. It's just my own stupidity that led me to where I am today. So I can't fault my upbringing whatsoever.
When did you start to take the sort of a different path or a wrong path, if you like?
I think when I was about 16, when I finished high school, I didn't want to continue on and get my HSC. I wanted to work. And it wasn't always easy finding work. So, I just met up with the wrong crew and things grew from there.
How did you become become involved in drug trafficking?
Well, a friend just approached me and said, would you like to get involved in this? And without thinking about the consequences, I was thinking more about the money that was involved in it, which in retrospect wasn't that much, actually. But at the time I thought, oh, wow. With that, I could buy a car, I could fast-track my life. Like I said, cut corners, really. Easy cash, fast cash.
And how much were you promised to be paid?
$15,000, which is a lot to an 18-year-old. But when you look back at it now, it's peanuts, it's nothing.
So what were you going to do with that $15,000?
Probably buy a car. And just wasted, probably. Knowing me back then, wasted.
How do you feel about what you've done to your family?
I regret it. If I could change it, I definitely would. So now it's just trying to do the best that I possibly can in here with what I have to show them that I'm a changed person, to show them that I deserve a second chance, not just in society, but to them as well. And they'll always love me, because I'm their family, their son, their brother. But I feel that I owe it to them to show them that I can be the best possible me in here.
What impact did it have on them that you saw?
My sister got really depressed when I got arrested. She became anorexic. She got really skinny. It was really tough on her. My older sister had trouble as well. I had people harassing my family, not just media, but other people as well. There's some hate mail, things like that. It was tough on them because my family never knew what I was up to. I never had an extensive criminal history back home at all. So I think that would be the very last thing they expected me to get involved in. So it was very tough on my family to come to grips with it. Yeah.
How do you mentally cope with the thought that you will never leave here?
It's tough. So my mind keeps going back to the possibility of our sentence being reduced at some point based on good behaviour. So it's just every day, it's just a struggle just to keep doing the good things, even though all around you sometimes can be chaos. You can have other prisoners just going mental, going crazy because of their own circumstances. But I can't fall into that. I've got to just focus on myself and look what my reward is, because they don't have a life sentence. They can go and do whatever they want with little to no consequences. My consequences are huge. If I stuff up and make a mistake, I potentially could be here for the rest of my life. So I've got to make sure that every day I'm doing the best that I can and that I have the best chance to get a reduction.
Do you cry much, or How do you
not anymore? To,
not anymore. But you did.
I cried when I had the death penalty, only because of the reactions of my family. That was so tough. But aside from that, I don't cry anymore because I remind myself I'm here because of me. So there's no point in crying. No one's hurt me. I've hurt myself.
And what are your strongest characteristics?
Will be patience. I've had to learn patience. So that's what you hear from the guards a lot is sabar, which means patience. Be patient and all good will come.
What's the worst thing you've seen in here?
The worst thing was seeing someone that I was close to. I mean, I wasn't exactly close to him, but a friend, he was another foreigner, he was a Japanese guy. He was depressed, but he didn't tell anybody about that, about his depression. And he went and hid behind the clinic and hung himself. So that was a bit tough. He'd been here for about 5 years, and he did have quite a long sentence. I think he had about another 10 more years to go. So it was tough when he hung himself. And it's just a reminder that if you're not doing good in here, if you're not being positive and everything, that's the alternative to being positive, is the negatives and the suicidal thoughts. And he actually went through with it.
You told me a story a while ago about what people used to bring you in the beginning, you know, when they came to visit. And one of those things was this, the red skin, you know,
yeah,
probably a sign of your age.
And Milkos and just candy.
Just tell me about that. What you know, when you were first in here, just 18, 19, not even into your 20s yet.
Yeah.
You're just a kid, you know. What are they bringing you?
I was getting a lot of comfort food. I guess people thought with stress, a lot of people talk about chocolate and things like that being a good stress release. So I had a lot of chocolate, and I picked out to the point where you get sick. And people say, oh, just eat it slow. You don't need to eat it all in one go. I can't do that. I know I've got if I have it, I got to finish it. If I don't have it, I don't want it. So my mind's telling me, Matt, you got chocolate in the cupboard, go and eat it. So I go and open it, have a bar of it, all of it. And then it just starts screaming at me again, come on, Matt. It's going to go bad. The ant's going to get into it. Just finish it. You've already ate most of it anyway. Like, oh, well, okay. So friends would bring chocolate. They'd bring candy bars, junk food.
What was your favourite lolly?
A friend, it used to be my favourite until my friend brought me a whole box of Curly Whirlies. I don't think they're making them anymore, but they brought me a whole box of Curly Whirlies. I finished the whole thing in about a week. So it was, yeah, Curly Whirlies and Redskins.
What would be your message to whoever would make the decision? I suppose at the moment it's Joko Widodo. So what would be your message to President Widodo, who could make a decision to grant you a reduction in your sentence and clemency?
I think my message to the President would be, I understand his hard stance on drugs, and society's getting ruined because of drugs, it's true. Prisoners can change. Please have a look at what we're doing in here and what's going on in other prisons. And please believe that inmates can change. And yeah, just please just have a look at us.
Matthew Norman speaking to Samantha Hawley. The election in PNG has not gone according to anyone's plan. It's been disorganised and disrupted, and it's generated a degree of scepticism and disillusionment that's surprising for a young country where even the most cynical people still believe in the power of democracy. Here's our PNG correspondent, Eric Torchek.
There was such excitement and unease about PNG's elections. They're a remarkable opportunity for 5 million voters to have their say, but they also generate disputes, tension and violence. I think it's undeniable that the optimism which preceded this election has now turned to intense disappointment or anger for many voters. Not about the outcome, which, thanks to endless and incomprehensible delays, is unclear, but about the process itself. Tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of people were denied the chance to vote because they were either struck off or weren't added to the electoral roll. There have been problems with the roll in the past, but this time opposing candidates allege widespread deliberate manipulation occurred, something that's difficult to substantiate due to a lack of verifiable information. The members of PNG's Electoral Advisory Committee, an oversight body, resigned because they weren't given this data by the Electoral Commission. Then came the characteristic disputes between candidates and polling officials and allegations of wrongdoing and mismanagement. Some of the claims are spurious, but some are supported by evidence, thanks to the increasing number of people with camera phones. The response to some claims from election authorities has added to the confusion and disillusionment. When presented with clear video evidence of vote tampering in one booth, the Electoral Commissioner decided to count all but one of the boxes anyway, because polling officials told him the count was fine. The same polling officials caught on camera excluding voters from the booth and allowing a candidate's supporters to stuff a box with ballots. Polling in Port Moresby was embarrassingly delayed after election workers went on strike over unpaid allowances. Then the city's election manager was caught with a large amount of cash in his car and arrested. He told police the money was the allowances for the polling workers. He was replaced and police said charges would be laid after the election. Then the replacement manager got arrested. He was charged for slapping a scrutineer, who complained when the manager stopped the media from photographing a disputed ballot box. The spat saw film crews banned from the main counting centre for days, further undermining confidence in the process. Counting in some seats has taken more than 2 weeks, an absurd length of time that's forced the Electoral Commissioner to seek legal advice about whether he can extend the deadline to return the election writs. 3 days out, three quarters of seats still need to be declared. The many problems have provoked strident criticism from PNG's growing cohort of commentators. The Commissioner took court action against one well-known blogger who had started calling him Tomato instead of his actual surname, Gamato. Instead of serving the writ on the blogger, the Commissioner's lawyer sought to have it published in the daily newspapers, then posted on Facebook himself to warn any keyboard warriors against criticising the Commissioner. The case could be the first time someone's been restrained by a court from commenting about a certain topic on social media, and Papua New Guinea's Media Council sees it as a dangerous precedent. As the counting grinds painfully towards completion, the political parties are swinging into recruitment mode. No single party is likely to win a majority, which means they have to form coalitions to form government. Up to a third of the seats could be won by independents, who could be the difference between a party running the country and sitting on the opposition benches. No one wants to be in opposition here. It's a lonely place in PNG, where being in government affords far too many advantages. So now the people, or at least some of them, have spoken, it's down to party power brokers, deal makers and number crunchers. On one side is the People's National Congress Party of Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, presumed to have far more money to offer, arguably better organised and certainly quicker off the mark, but inarguably dealing with an electoral backlash. On the other side is almost everybody else, the once powerful parties of founding Prime Minister Sir Michael Somare, Pungu and National Alliance seem rejuvenated and confident, even though they're likely to win fewer seats than Peter O'Neill's PNC. The major parties take candidates to so-called camps in provincial centres where they book out a hotel and nut out who'll get what. It's a high-stakes confidence game and no one wants to be left behind. 110 men and perhaps one woman wrangling for PNG's political future and almost 8 million people waiting for their decision rather than the other way around. From Port Moresby, this is Eric Tworchek for Correspondence Report.
In Britain, a media storm has erupted over a story that might leave a sour taste in your mouth. A 5-year-old girl was fined nearly $250 for selling a few jugs of homemade lemonade with her father without a permit. The incident left the girl in tears and some of the country asking what sort of things are children allowed to do these days. From London, here's correspondent James Glenday.
On this side of the globe, the great British summer is upon us. It's a rare collection of weeks, occasionally months, where the English weather is pleasant enough to actually spend time outside. Andre Spicer, a New Zealander with an Australian partner, wanted to use the long London days to encourage his daughter's entrepreneurial side.
So a couple of weeks ago, my daughter had her school fete, so her school fair, and she saw these stalls being laid out. And she kind of got the idea that she'd like also to run a stall.
So and how old's your daughter?
She's 5 years old.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So she's in her first year at school. And she thought, okay, I'd love to have a stall myself.
They settled on a lemonade stall. After a shopping trip, some online recipe searches, and a 30-minute stint with a blender, the pair were ready to go. They took four jugs and a handmade sign to the end of their street.
And there was a big music festival on there at the time, so there were dozens of people streaming by.
So business was good.
I guess so, yeah, yeah. And then people saw her and they smiled. We went through the four pitchers, the four jugs of lemonade quite quickly.
It was hardly a grand money-making exercise. They were charging just 50 pence, about 82 cents, for a small cup, and £1 for a big one. But when they were nearly finished, the long arm of the law intervened, and they were approached by four enforcement officers from the local council.
And were you expecting to be approached by enforcement officers selling lemonade with your five-year-old daughter?
No, it never would have crossed my mind, to be honest with you. I mean, I grew up in New Zealand, spent time in Australia, and I can't imagine that kind of thing happening there. I expected at the very worst that they might say to me, okay, well, you know, the law says this, so unfortunately we're going to have to ask you to pack up and go home, right. Which I would have been fine with.
And what happened?
So then they went through, they had a kind of legalistic script that they had to read through, you know, section 157.3 wow. According to this, and then the fine, and during it my daughter then began crying and I had to pick her up and hold her.
Right.
Yeah.
And this, obviously by now I'm assuming that this has turned it into a fairly unpleasant experience for your daughter and maybe yourself as well.
Yeah, so I had to take her back home and she was crying and calm her down by showing her favourite film, which is Brave.
Mr. Spicer is a professor of organisational behaviour at the Cass Business School in London, and by his own admission, he perhaps should have known a permit was required. He sent the council a tweet and tried to assess what had happened.
Then I thought about it a bit more. You know, I'm paid to think about stuff sometimes, and I thought, this seems absolutely nuts, and I wonder if this has happened to other children in my borough. So I wrote a short thing for a newspaper here, and then, of course, as soon as this hits the newsstands, then the council drops the fine straight away. So they drop the fine, fair enough and all good, but I really hope that other people aren't being fined and discouraged.
Last time we spoke about large organisations doing silly things because they're effectively following rules, following orders. Is this an example of that? It seems like it.
Absolutely. So what you see is that these people essentially... councils in the UK have had their funding significantly cut back, so they have to make money and they're trying to make money through fines. And essentially they just go and apply the letter of the law without using basic, what we might call common sense, thinking it about a bit. I wanted to say during this encounter to the guy, just think about this for a second. Let's just think about it.
Finding a five-year-old.
Yeah, I know, exactly. But unfortunately I was a bit too stunned to do that.
The saga has triggered a broader debate in the local media. Some have claimed the lemonade fine is an example of Britain's love of regulation. Others see it as a consequence of years of budget austerity, or conversely, the sign of a bloated bureaucracy intent on attacking entrepreneurial thinking. For the record, Mr. Spicer believes it shows how much less children are allowed to do in modern society.
Yeah, so there's some amazing work in social geography which shows us basically our grandparents used to be able to go to the edge, you know, miles away. Then we were able to go to the edge of our neighbourhood, and then our kids, they're able to go to the door or the front of their house. And, okay, there are valid safety concerns, but it means that children's universes are being closed down, and basically what they see is screens and iPads, and their parents get stressed out because they spend a lot of time with them. And I guess what I'd like to do is to try and encourage parents and their kids to go out and, you know, use public space again, basically.
But plans for another pop-up lemonade stall are currently on hold. Even with the right permit, Mr. Spicer says his daughter doesn't think it's a good idea, and they're going to find other ways to spend the summer holidays. In London, this is James Gleenday for Correspondence Report.
That's all from me and our correspondents for today, but next week, meet the man who tried to save Chinese dissident and Nobel laureate Liao Xiaobo before his death under guard in hospital a few weeks ago.
He co-authored a document called Charter 08, and that was a document that called for political reform in China. This very eloquent document received about 10,000 signatures. Now, 10,000 signatures in China, given the size of the population, is not a very big number. And in fact, as I've said, there have been many similar such movements in the past. But for some reason, Beijing decided to really clamp down very hard on this.
That's Bill Birtles with Jonathan Cam next week on Correspondence Report. See you then. Back to you, Tom.
Thanks, Elizabeth. And we look forward to that report on the late Chinese Nobel Prize winner.